podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the Donny review system, Diogo. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
Hello and welcome to the Nat Coombs Show. Good to have you with us, gang. Our week six review coming up very shortly. Iron Mike in the house, his regular spot. He's our review resident, and he's got a lot to be getting into. The Ravens rolling, the Cowboys getting the job done in a thriller against New England. Dak Prescott banged up. Wonder how serious that is going to be. Oh, the Chargers getting derailed by Baltimore. We'll look into that a bit more. Arizona staying unbeaten. The Raiders sticking it to the haters. All kinds of stories to be getting into. And, of course, that thrilling finish at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. It's so much fun doing the BBC game with OC, with J Bell, with Iron Mike, Katie Shanahan dropping by as well. Fine crew, lots of fun. We'll get into all of that and more. Maybe even sneak in a few questions from the mailbag as well. So you're in the right place. Sit back, relax, and enjoy our week six review. Iron Mike in the house. Good to see you. But what we should probably open with is the fact that I was planning to open the show by shouting out to you, I own you, I've always owned you, until it became apparent that you would have had no idea what I was talking about because you missed Aaron Rodgers' chest puffing to the Bears fans, and you would have taken that as a very aggressive opening gambit, Mike, I guess.
It would have been a very aggressive opening gambit anyway. I'm glad you told me about it, though, so I can be prepared. Now I'm going to have to you know, scour the headlines. Maybe Kirk Cousins said something really good.
Well, listen, you're going to the wrong places, Mike. TMZ is where the action's at. On a moment. Let me tell you. Good to see you, bud. Fresh, of course, from a fine stint at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium yesterday. Mike and I were covering the game, as I hope you all know. I hope you're all watching us on the BBC, although different setup this time around because of COVID restrictions. So we couldn't have all four of us in the booth. So me, OC and J-Bell up top, and I and Mike down pitch side, right in the thick of it, along with the excellent Katie Shanahan. And you look like you're having a lot of fun, Mike.
A lot more than I would have had with you three guys. That's for sure. Katie was great.
One anecdote from the pregame, because doing those rehearsals, I and Mike, just a sound check, we throw down to Mike and Katie, make sure they can hear us, as Mike was suggesting. One of my favorite moments of all the years you and I worked with.
Yeah, there's a funny thing about that, because all of your favorite moments tend to put me in a bad light. But yeah, go ahead, I can guess what's coming.
On. One of my favorite moments is singing karaoke with you in New Orleans, Mike. And that was definitely
yeah, and that shows me in a great light.
That was a great light. Mustang Sally was a great moment. Was Mike saying, "Thanks, Dad, I'm here pitch side," and speeding, and all the micromaniacs behind me. And Mike turns around and tries to hype the crowd up, and one guy gets up and starts laughing, and everyone else is just looking utterly confused.
Yeah, they were in a different section. You couldn't see them on camera.
I thought that's what it was. I know you were getting a lot of love down there, bud, so that was great to see. And it was good to have you on the broadcast as ever. Let's talk about the game that we saw then. So what the things you mentioned, that when you're pitch side, when you're that close to the action, you miss out on certain things, but you catch other things. Talk us through the former. What are the things that you see you're more perceptive to when you're that close to
the most interesting one is that while they're near you, especially, you get a much better idea of the way the lines are playing. And so in the first quarter, I mean, the first thing I think I said to you guys was Jacksonville really is dominating the pit, at the line of scrimmage on both sides of the ball. Mm-hmm. And Miami was finessing them in a sense, or trying to finesse them. Miami could not run the ball.
I think described it as patty cake is how he described it.
Yeah. And defensively, line. I saw a play, the one just before you came to me, where they were completely confused on defense. Nobody knew where they were supposed to be.
Right.
OC had spotted that up from up above, which is usually the way you see that, obviously.
Let's key in on that, because you had Xavier Howard and Byron Jones, of course, the 1 and 2 corner punch out, key emissions on the offensive side of the ball as well. Did we underplay that a little bit? I mean, of course, we talked about it, and each of those players significant, Devontae Parker, Preston Williams out on the receiving side, but it felt as if here are four, certainly three of the best players on this Miami roster, and they're all missing. And I'm not sure whether that was talked up enough.
Probably not. And I thought, you know, I thought that the lack of wide receivers, Miami was using their tight ends basically. And early in the game, it was easy to see what they were doing. And then eventually Jacksonville adjusted and started taking away, which we also was able, were on. But, you know, I mean, it's one thing to say, oh, you've got to put the ball into the hands of your playmakers like Jaylen Waddle. But the reality was Jaylen Waddle had 10 catches for 70 yards.
Right.
Never did he get a big gain out of any of those quick passes. His big value to them was opening up the field under for the tight ends underneath to go down the seams when they were able to do, when they caught them in zone coverage mostly. And defensively, you could see the way Brian Flores was outthinking them sort of, but Trevor Lawrence made up for that. And I think Miami really lacks. Trent Green got into this a little bit. I think they really made a mistake in letting Kyle Van Noy go.
You're right.
Because they thought Van Ginkle was going to replace him, and they drafted Jalen Phillips, who's going to be, I think, a good pass rusher in the league, but he's kind of a one-trick pony. Van Noy may not be great, but he's smart, and you can use him in a variety of roles and know he's going to perform pretty well. So he can be a pass rusher. He can do coverage. He can be an inside linebacker, you know, and a plugger. And they miss, I think they miss that flexibility. That might've been a tough, and they miss Devin Godshow as well, because Raekwon Davis had a brief spell where he was really effective inside, but you really want rotation inside. So I thought Miami should have won the game, obviously. I think they got a couple of bad breaks, and there were a couple of plays that didn't go their way. They should have had a bigger lead early, and that came back to haunt them. And Trevor Lawrence did make a difference. You know, Miami had things covered, and Lawrence managed to escape coverage enough to keep plays alive. James Robbins had...
It's interesting what you said about the line, because, of course, the Jags very banged up on that line, and missing center, and they were play calling to get him out of the pocket a lot of the time, weren't they?
Definitely. And that was going to be the kind of real battle, because the Dolphins were more or less scheming their pass rush like a Bill Belichick team. It's not two great ends coming down and crashing down on you. It's schemes and it's guessing when you're going to pass, and when you're in the, and when he was in the pocket, he was always under pressure because they reacted to it. So they got, most of the time they were trying to get him out of the pocket.
Yeah.
And that worked really well, because he throws really well on the run, you know, I think as the Dolphins became one dimensional, it's always harder to work, because one mistake's going to kill you. And you know, Tua's one interception was a real killer for them.
So we try to work out in the booth whether the rib injury was the primary cause of that pick, because he underthrew it.
I don't think so. Well, I think
you weren't buying that.
I just think it was a bad throw. You know, I think he thought he could place that in out as a low line drive throw. There was a lot of juice on it. I mean,
did you? I thought he underthrew it. I mean, he obviously underthrew it, but I mean, I didn't think he had much zip on it. I didn't think he had much zip on it.
And you know, I don't know if that was the time the injury came back to haunt him or not. You know, I think the real things were those two challenges.
The back-to-back Flores challenges when he hadn't thrown one all season.
First one was inexplicable to me, simply because I thought, I didn't have a great view of it, obviously. So when they ruled it a completion, I said, fine. And then they changed the ruling, which unprompted, you know, I didn't even see the officials gathering to change it. It was as if someone had come down in John Hussey's ear and said, change that. So they did. So when Flores challenged it, my first thing was, are you challenging the original ruling or the change of the ruling? Because John Hussey is not going to overturn himself. He's one of the toughest referees to give a challenge.
And so it's a great point. So you got that fact alone, the knowledge of the crews that you're dealing with and the likelihood of depending on how dogmatic they are, but also the core principle, which we touched upon on the show, which is Flores is going to get the criticism for that. And the head coach, because he is the one physically throwing the red flag, will always get the criticism. But he's got people around him telling him whether it's a challenge or not. It's
And I mean, looking at the replays as best you could, I could see where it was the kind of call where either way, you're not going to overturn it. But then the question is, why did you call it complete in the first place? Mm. You know, it looked like his hand was underneath the ball. And you know, you hear them trying to make excuses like, oh, well, he was using the ground. The pressure of the ground kept it in possession. But if it didn't hit the ground, if his hand's underneath it, it's a completion. That's how that's how you catch the ball.
Well, if it doesn't hit the ground, sure. But yeah.
And then the next one. I think the same thing applies. And I know that New York makes those calls, not John Hussey, but I'm sure when the referee says, well, I don't think so, that will have some effect on it, or he's not going to argue with it. And that one, to me, I thought his finger touched the ball, but
I mean, he had to watch it about 27 times, and that's the point, isn't it? It just wasn't clear cut, and it's only going to get overturned if it is.
That's right. That's exactly the point. And it reminded me of the, Julian Edelman won the famous croquet ball through the, but that one they called a fumble and then overturned it.
Yes, because, right.
And to me, the evidence was
less click up,
was more so in this game that the finger had hit. And that, but you know, you can almost feel that kind of, I don't want this game to be decided on a fluke play like this. And of course, I'm the guy who bigged up Jamal Agnew at the start of the game. So I should be saying, well, yeah, okay, he didn't fumble that. That's Jamal Agnew out there. He's my man.
He's fine. He wouldn't make a mistake like that. Well, let's talk about how the game was decided. And we've got to give props to the under fire, the much maligned Urban Meyer, because it was an extraordinarily sharp call and passage of play, wasn't it? Because as the guys in the booth, on the comms team, I should say, so Trent Green, I think it was, specifically said, you got two options here. You're either going to flip it around, lateral, central, try and, you know, make a miracle happen, or he's going to heave it up to the end zone, buy a bit of time, scramble around, give his receivers time to get there, and then Biff and Baker style, see if he can pull it off. So he fires a line drive of his own in, and at first glance, I thought, Carlson, you were probably five steps ahead of me but he fired that in. And I thought, well, what? That was a ridiculous play. That was a waste. And then suddenly I realized the penny dropped. Brilliance. Bam, fires it in. Timeout called. 2 seconds left. Such smart play.
I was really surprised. It was 5 seconds down to one. And I was really surprised that there was still a second on the clock when I looked up. And I understood what they were trying to do when he threw it like that. And it was thrown low, which meant the receiver was on the ground. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you know, he's not automatically down, but he had somebody on him. And so, you know, you almost could hope that you didn't need to call the timeout. But yeah, I don't know who called it. Well, you know, whether it was Daryl Bevel or
Urban's taking the credit, I'm sure.
But yeah, well, but it was a really smart move, and Wright made it pay off. Yeah. The right stuff, as it were.
Nice. The crazy thing about this is Josh Lambeau, after the bye, will be back probably. And, you know, this guy will be back on a practice squad, or maybe even out of the league.
I don't know. You know, I don't see how you can do that. You know, Lambeau's been a really good kicker,
right,
in the past, but kickers go through these periods, you know, and I don't see how Wright could make 250 plus field goals in the most clutch of circumstances. I mean, when he made the one that tied the game, the Jacksonville players in front of me were running down the field like they just won the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
You know, and I turned to Kay and said, they haven't even won the game.
What was your sense on the sidelines, Mike, of Miami and Jacksonville in terms of fan base? Was it pretty even in the stadium?
It seemed that way at the beginning, but by the end of the game, it was very pro-Jacksonville.
All right.
I don't know whether that reflects the fact that they're London's team, or whether it reflects Trevor Lawrence, or whether they just, you know, like the idea of the comeback victory. But we were behind, our position was behind the Jacksonville bench. So most of the time my vision was being blocked by Cook, the punter, who was constantly taking snaps and bouncing the ball off his knee and then taking snaps as a holder for the place kicks and then taking more and then passing the ball around.
Very considerate of him, Mike. What do you got to
do? Yeah, well, he went in and shanked the punt right after he got in my way. I said, serves you right.
So on Trevor Lawrence, and I want to get your take on Tua and also the situation for Miami going forwards, because they're not going to make the playoffs this season now, pretty obviously, given they've fallen to 1-5, barring some kind of miracle happening, right? So final thoughts, seeing Trevor Lawrence first time up close and personal, the good and the bad from Lawrence. If you could summarize his key attributes, what really impressed you and stuff that he needs to work on.
You know, I would take mostly positives away from it. You know, I don't see much that he did wrong. They audibled once. I think he doesn't do that much, but he has the problems in the pocket. But that was really the line. He did sense a rusher coming at one point, you know, and from the blind side got a good pass away.
There was one bad decision he made when he was scrambling through and probably should have just either slid or gone out of bounds and went for the throw. And but that's par for the course of the rookie.
Rookie quarterback. I think he showed nothing that would say, oh God, they took this guy first overall, and decided he was going to be their starter. Yeah. I thought, he's going to be a solid quarterback in the league for sure. And
what about Tua? Is Tua going to be a solid quarterback?
That's a stranger question. He looked really good at times. He made a couple of bad decisions. One was actually the inverse of that. He should have kept the ball and taken a first down, but he threw the ball away. His accuracy comes and goes. He didn't get much of a chance to throw the deep ball, but when he threw it, that which I always think is his strong point.
Yeah, right. He's got it.
But I really think that Miami, more than Jacksonville, wants to be a run first team. But they don't have the horses. They don't have the line to be able to do
line. And I guess Gaskin has been banged up and perhaps it still isn't. I mean,
he didn't look 100%. Whereas the other two guys looked better. And Malcolm Brown, I thought, had a pretty good game because he made a couple of key pass blocks that otherwise Tua was a dead man.
They will be in the hunt, you'd think, for a running back and probably to strengthen that line. They've been trying
to strengthen the line for years.
That's true. And it's not playing out. But I think you could overreact. One can overreact to the Tua situation for that going full circle. The point you made right at the top, he was without. Because don't forget, Will Fuller's hardly, played five downs in this season. I know that was always a gamble, taking an injury.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. But, they got him because they know Tua's got the deep ball.
Right.
And, and he was the guy to take advantage of that. I think what we saw in the end was two not very good teams. Teams that lack consistency. To make plays when they need to. They're not so strong. Although I said Jacksonville dominated up front early, neither team is particularly strong up front. They're not deep enough to survive serious injuries. And right now they don't really have the big time playmakers that some of the better teams do. I think they're teams. It's a shame because it's a step backwards for Miami.
Yeah.
Buffalo
had this situation in maybe not to the same degree, but under McDermott, didn't they? They had a step back before they went forward. So
yeah, and teams do. And maybe we got too excited last year, but Miami had a good defense last year. I mean, they played really well defensively most of the season. And this year, obviously, they don't. I'm not putting it all down to Van Noy. But things just aren't click. They're not meshing the way that I think they expected them to mesh this season. And
well, let's
neither team is going to get in the playoffs. I don't think. I don't think a second team is going to get in the playoffs from either of those divisions. So even chasing the wild card, it may be too late now.
Oh, there's no, they're not. Miami aren't making the playoffs. Disappointingly, batch that up, clip that up, Ollie, because you can play that throughout the postseason. Let's follow Carl Van Noy. Of course, he's gone back to New England this season. Wild game between Dallas and the Patriots. The Cowboys edged in the end, but it was, I think, maybe not necessarily the game we expected. I think a lot of people thought that, that New England would neutralize this offense and it would be quite a low scoring affair, quite the opposite. And once again, Mike, we're coming out of this with everybody raving about Kellen Moore and the offensive genius Kellen Moore is, and he's going to land a head coaching gig next season. Yeah. What do you make of that particular battle, the offense versus this attritional Patriots defense?
Attritional is a good word for it. Like Miami, you know, you can see the similarities with Flores, and what they want to do most of the time is to get you into third down and then anticipate what you want to do and take that away from you. The problem we looked at before the game with Bill and Dallas was Dallas doesn't have one guy you can, you know, Bill's thing has always been take away their best weapon and make them beat you with when something you else. Yeah. Dallas has a lot of good weapons, you know, so that's a difficult proposition. So what they were trying to do, it looked to me, was to play situationally and then try to capitalize on it. And it worked pretty well in some ways. You give up points, but they could afford to.
What can stop is injury for Dak, I guess, could. He's having an MRI today, so we've got to keep a close eye on that. We're recording this Monday early afternoon. I mean, that would be, could be the return of the noosh, Mike.
Ben DiNucci. Dak was very impressive. You know, he stood in against the rush very well. The Patriots nearly got to him any number of times, but didn't. He got rid of the ball into the right places most of the time.
Yeah.
He made a couple of really good throws. The one to Wilson on the in the overtime, the over the shoulder on fourth and whatever it was, fourth and eight or something, that was a brilliant throw and catch. You know, they got lucky in a couple of ways. So off that four, you know, when they had third and 25 or whatever, you know, it should have been really that's where the Patriots made their, you know, their big mistake. But it's where when you have five weapons out there, you can do it. I love the way that Kevin Harlan calls passing plays. You know, he's like, and that play, you know, and he completes a pass to the receiver, and then he's waiting for the spotter to tell which
person. Who is he?
Well, it's almost
this
every
season,
time.
Even half of Harlan, I guess, in that respect.
Yeah,
and well, Trayvon Diggs getting a huge amount of buzz as defensive player of the year, and rightly so. He's been in lights out form. His seventh interception of the season returned for a score, of course. Mike, what makes him such a good
quarterback? That's an interesting question. And I honestly, interceptions are kind of like fumbles in a way where you think it's, you're in the right place at the right time and the ball comes to you as opposed to making plays. But that's an exaggeration because you have to make plays to get interceptions. He's got good ball skills. He seems to be able to find crowds. He leaving, you know, following the quarterback's eyes, leaving his position as his zone or man to get to where the ball's going. And it's been remarkably successful. And it was a great return. that was the best part to watch. But like I say, to me, that was kind of the key play of the game.
Yeah.
And Mac Jones has taken a beating. I mean, this guy's been hit a lot. If it continues at this pace, it's going to be David Carr kind of level. But he's still making plays.
He did it right off the back of that, right? I mean, outfoxed Diggs on the very next drive.
And to me, there was the other key play of the game was an uncalled. And you can't really complain in a sense if you're New England, because I've got the penalty. Dallas had 12 penalties for 115 yards, which is a Blandino all by itself. and the Patriots only had five for 47. But, you know, when you look at those Dallas penalties, a couple of them were really gruesome. You know, I mean, the hold and personal foul where, you're grabbing a lineman's horse collaring another lineman from behind when he's beaten. But the one that didn't get called was in the overtime when New England had third and three and N'Keal Harry was out there and Mac Jones threw to his outside shoulder and Anthony Brown was 30 was the defensive back, and he basically turned Harry around so that he couldn't reach over his outside shoulder.
Fair enough.
and you knew it was a penalty because Jim Nance said, and no flag on that. Just very, you know, very low key, but you knew that he'd seen it. And then Bill, of course, punted on fourth and three, which is another thing. I think it's a big item of discussion this week is he's playing very conservatively. Because I don't think he thinks that they can get the big plays to win games. So he's kind of playing in the hopes that his defense is going to get him the wins. Mm. And I don't know if there's, you know, unleash the Mac. I don't know if that's really, I don't know if you can do that. You know,
if you can do that now, or do you think he's just never going to be that kind of quarterback?
I think it's a now situation. Mm. I think he's not quite fully, he doesn't fully trust him to, and Mac, in fairness, you know, is not a breakdown kind of quarterback where if the play breaks down, because you know on fourth and three, they're going to be coming at you.
Right.
But Mac's not going to be able to sprint to the outside and make, mm-hmm. you know, now maybe they ought to experiment with more rolling pockets or whatever.
Sure. One thing I'm surprised about, and we got into this a little bit on, edge rush, I think, last week, but Hunter Henry, who got another score, of course, in this game, but only three receptions between him and Jonnu Smith, and the latter has barely been used, Mike. And we came into the season thinking, oh, okay, well, the acquisition of these two, we're going to see a return to a two tight end set, and they're going to be, particularly with a rookie quarterback, a fundamental part of this offense. Why do you think McDaniels hasn't explored that further?
It's a really difficult one to figure out. I mean, there were two factors going on. One was the overpay for Hunter and Smith and Aguilar and Kendrick Bourne.
Right.
None of whom are game breakers. They're not number ones in that. I mean, Henry and Smith are probably top 10 tight ends, basically.
Yeah.
But not the top five. You know, they're not the guys you game plan against. Ditto Aguilar. Aguilar had the one big season. They haven't used him the way the Raiders did last year as a deep threat.
Deep threat, right?
Bourne is what he is, you know, a good receiver, good number two, say. I don't think Harry's ever going to be anything better. And Jacoby Myers is a number two kind of guy who, you know, he got a 2-point conversion. He's never gotten a touchdown. He's caught more passes without a touchdown than anybody in NFL history because he's not a big play. You know, he doesn't get those breakaway plays. He's a possession, almost the definition of a possession receiver. So, you know, why they're not using the tight ends more is problematic, because if you have the two, why not go to them? And they drafted two the year before, Keene and Asiasi, but who barely get on the field. Mm. You know, I would be looking for them to use more like three tight end sets, because you know, both Smith and Hunter are can get down the field.
But it plays to everything, you know, the points you've made. It's a leaky line. It's a quarterback they're using conservatively and short gain. And it's the comfort blanket mechanic that a rookie quarterback enjoys.
The best way I can explain it is that I think their image, they wanted to be a run first team, and the tight ends so far have pretty much done their job better than I expected as blocking tight ends. Mm. But the line hasn't. They thought their offensive line was good. Everybody did. I thought the offensive line was going to be the strong point of the team. Trent Brown's been out most of the time. The other guys, there's a couple of COVIDs, there's an injury. Oh, Onwenu's been really good consistently. But the offensive line is not as strong as it was supposed to be. And I think what that means is they're trying to be overly protective offensively. They're trying not to open things up with the tight ends. They ran the ball really well, or at least Harris did, and Ramondre Stevenson had a couple of good runs as well.
But he's just glad he got the ball at all. I think he knows that maybe he's still got a shot.
Yeah, you see, that's what I was about to say. But you know, Harris lost the first game with a fumble. Stevenson then had a big fumble later on, and Bill benches them like they were rookies, which they, in a sense, Harris is, and Stevenson it certainly is. I don't know if it, you know, you remember when Tom Coughlin cut, what was his name? His name was Mac, running back from Temple. Pretty good running back, and he fumbled twice in one game, and he got cut
because Coughlin was the Tiki Barber. He was, of course, famously got made.
Yeah, and he made Tiki carry. But the thing was that he didn't, you know, he didn't cut his starting running back when his starting running back fumbled.
Sure.
And it's one of those things. I'm not sure that works, especially with the young players
anymore. You know? Is that the key? Doesn't work anymore. It's an old school.
I saw Stevenson probably lost a couple of yards on one of his runs because he had two hands around the ball, where if he'd had one on the ball, he might have been able to make a cut. a bit harder. But, you know, and I said to myself, well, he's no way he's going to fumble that one. But, you know, I just think New England's probably a year away, which is going to be a problem for them because they'll have other, you know, they've already let Stephon Gilmore go for nothing, basically,
which
I always think is a bad sign for teams. It was one of my problems with Jacksonville was they were letting guys go for Joe Schobert, for example, for nothing, you know, just to clear out.
I was looking at their schedule.
They got the Jets this week.
They could take 8 wins. They could still, there's an outside chance they could, I'm hanging on to for dear life because I backed them to make the playoffs before the start of the season, but they, you know, they have got, it depends whether, you know, Miami will probably play them hard, even if their season is.
Miami always gives them trouble, you know, even before Flores.
Always a tough game. Yeah. So it is a reach. And of course they got the Bills twice. So they got to get one out of those, which is an ask, but I don't think New England are necessarily at the stick of fork in them stage quite yet.
Again, you know, Buffalo's going to win the division, so that's the playoff spot. The wild cards will come probably two from the north, between Cleveland, Cincinnati, and Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And the one that doesn't come from the north will probably come from the west. I can't see any team in either the south or the east finishing 10-7. To be honest.
Well, how about those Raiders? Let's go there in the West then. Winning without
adding insult to injury. Mm-hmm.
Kenyon Drake, who I preseason suggested, I thought was quite a canny pickup by Mike Mayock and the Raiders. Drafted him in different fantasy leagues I'm in. Cut him just a few days ago from a number of fantasy leagues. And then, of course, he has 73 all-purpose yards and 2 touchdowns, Mike, right on cue.
Well, one of the big questions about that Gruden team was why Kenyon Drake wasn't playing. Why did they go out and get him and then not use him? You know, because he is, why wasn't Kenyon Drake a starter from day one? Because he wasn't a great pass blocker. But then went to Arizona and he shone as a runner and receiver.
And receiver, right?
So, you know, okay, so don't put him in when you want him to pass block. You know, it's like if he's in, either have somebody else there or shift your pass blocking some other way. Couldn't figure out what Gruden was on about. And one of the things that's been said by a number of people over the years about Gruden was that he's always in love with someone else's players. He's always in love with the guys he had before,
yes.
You know, and he's never happy with the guys he's got now.
Well, he's had this with Derek Carr, you know, the whole time.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Exactly.
And Carr had a big game. The Raiders moved to 4-2, and a significant week for them because, and this was pointed out a lot, thankfully, that this is a franchise with a real tradition of progressive behavior, right? So it was...
In some ways, yeah.
Well,
as long as you don't consider, you know, team of Jack Tatum, Ben Davidson, you know, Hacksaw, all that kind of stuff, you know, as long as we leave that out, they've been
pushing. I didn't say it was unequivocally progressive, Mike, but it was significantly progressive. And they were. There's no doubt about that.
Oh, right? Yeah. Al Davis had no, you know, the only prejudice he had was in favor of guys who wanted to win. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, a pioneer in lots of ways. And it was funny because had we had time, I would have gone into a long lecture. I'll probably write it up for my Patreon column this week about the choices you have in hiring head coaches between scheme and culture, basically. And one of the interesting things is when you go culture, I look at it as when you take the guys who aren't big name coordinators and you make them head coaches. Brian Flores, he wasn't even the defensive coordinator in England, although everyone knew he had a sharp mind. Mike Tomlin, Andy Reid, you know, they weren't in the coordinator spots, but they carried that idea that they could build a culture. Al Davis was one of the first guys to do that sort of thing when he hired John Madden. Who was a line coach. You know, Madden wasn't there for schemes. Madden was there because he got the Raiders culture and he was going to make that work. And that was Al's thing. It became old when Al got old, I think, you know, and just win baby wasn't going to do it anymore in the NFL. But they continued, you know, he continued to, I wouldn't say experiment, but he continued to work work on the fringes of kind of like personnel management, his own instincts, they became less and less, you know, he tended to want guys who could run fast in his last, years, you know, he built a great 4x100 meter relay team, but not necessarily a good football team.
Heywood Bay, seventh, I think is probably the pinnacle
but,
of that.
You know, I think Gruden, culture wise, if I were a player, I wouldn't be trusting John Gruden. And that's always been my impression of him.
So before all this broke, you maintain that perspective of him.
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, I've not been sold on Gruden as a quarterback whisperer. I see no evidence of that in his career, that he take a young quarterback and bring him along. He didn't do it at Tampa. Mm. He didn't do it at Oakland. He did it, you know, Rich Gannon was his quarterback in Oakland. He won the Super Bowl with Tony Dungy's defense and Brad Johnson at quarterback. He couldn't wait to move on from Brad Johnson.
Right.
First chance he got. Now, you know, I'm not sure how much those emails play to Bruce Allen, for whom I have a much lower regard than John Gruden, you know, but it's the kind of stuff that if politicians do it, they get away with it by saying it's locker room talk.
Yes.
I mean, in fairness, the emails John Gruden said, you know, there's nothing that Donald Trump said before he got elected president, and everybody knew it. So obviously our social standards for football coaches are a lot higher than they are for presidents.
let's talk what happened, if we're staying in the West, what's happened to the Broncos, Mike, because
injuries.
That's the sole reason that they,
not the sole reason, but it's, I think it's the big one.
Were we not overhyping them at 3-0?
They hadn't beaten it. They had not beaten a team that had won a game. So I wasn't, but people were overhyping them at the time. They should be an explosive offensive team, and they're not quite, which leads me to think that I may have been overhyping Teddy a bit, because Teddy might be a game manager, more or less. And he's kind of retreating into Tyrod Taylor territory.
Right.
Which is not a bad thing. I mean, you know, Tyrod Taylor's not a bad quarterback.
Yes.
But he's not, you know, there's, he's not
too
explosive.
Many strong quarterbacks around him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. He's kind of the guy you always want to be able to move on from
when
you've got him. Fitz would be kind of in that category.
Yeah, that 26 to 32 ranking, and you take the rookies out of that, those guys that have been around a few years. And so other games I want to talk about, well, let's look at the Browns and getting blown up injury. We're talking injuries, of course. That's a key reason why they are on the skids at the moment. We've got to give props to Baker, though, for the Hail Mary, and in particular the Fox director, because this was obviously the end of the first half, and the Fox director cut to one of the best. What the have I just seen shots of Kyler Murray from the sidelines? It was amazing. Amazing.
If you're gonna cut to somebody watching Hail Mary, it shouldn't be the smallest guy on the field.
right.
But basically, yes. I don't know about Baker's injury, how much, you know. I mean, if we talk about Tua with the broken rib, and anyone who's had one knows how painful that is.
Oh yeah.
In any circumstance when you do anything.
Let alone trying to play quarterback in the NFL. It's a fair point.
Playing quarterback in the NFL with a separated shoulder on your other arm, you know, not your throwing arm, but it's still going to affect you. It's going to affect you every time you're hit. It's got to upset the kind of your kind of rhythm. So there's that. But basically the problem with the Browns was injury to the extent, not only both their starting tackles, but Hubbard, the third tackle, was already on IR.
Yeah.
You know, who is basically a good third tackle. He did that role in Pittsburgh for a number of years. So that hurts you, especially against a team with a good outside pass rush. And the Browns are a team that run play action and run Baker from a moving pocket and stuff. And they found themselves moving into that outside pass rush all too often. Nick Chubb wasn't playing.
Sure.
It's like everybody's saying, the offensive line, Nick Chubb wasn't playing. You know, you could argue that the Browns are two back version of Tennessee. You know, and what they want to do is be a run first team and control the clock. And then you look and say, who's he throwing to? You know, does he really have?
Beckham's, I mean, yeah.
Is it really stretching another team's defense? I don't think so.
So let me ask you this then: if we're talking about the deep waters of the playoffs, and a point that you and I have got into pretty much from the start of the season, certainly in recent weeks, about the Chiefs, right? And the book on the Chiefs right now, outside of, and of course they bounce back. Yeah,
I'll tell you, the book on the Chiefs was written by a French surrealist in about 1912, you know, and illustrated by Pablo Picasso.
Love it.
While he was high.
The Chiefs. The line re-upped, not enough weapons beneath the A-listers. Everybody's worked the Chiefs out. This is the narrative. You know how to beat them. Tampa blueprint. You talked about it yourself. You know how to cut out the deep ball, and the slice and dice isn't going to cut it anymore. There's confidence with Andy Reid, with Mahomes. The fact that on paper, if not in practice, there is talent beneath Kelce and beneath Tyreek Hill on that roster, that you can have faith, at least hold a belief that they will find a way around, that there's a versatility to that overall setup. Is that the problem with the Browns, that for all the offensively specifically I'm talking about here, that for all the progress Stefanski has instilled, keep it simple with Baker, he's good at that level, great ground game, that it's too one-dimensional? If we're talking about defenses working teams out, is that the problem with the Browns? That you take away, to your point, Mike, one or two key pieces and they unravel.
I mean, remember the Browns couldn't hold on and beat the Chiefs when they had the Chiefs beaten and then couldn't hold on for the win. 32-29 was it? I think you're right to an extent there. But what you just described makes me now think that you could make a really good comparison between Stefanski's old team, the Browns and the Vikings, you know, and the Vikings had a very Brown-like win in Carolina, and they're always going to kind of backdoor cover one of the playoff spots, and then go out in the first round. And right now the Browns have the feeling of that kind of team.
Great defense.
On a good day. Yeah. Their defense is awfully reliant on the pass rush. I think, people over. I thought the secondary would be much better with the guys they picked up, and they haven't really played to that level so far. And maybe
it's played. And Newsom's hardly played.
Yeah, Newsom's was back, but not really a factor. Ward's a great player. You know, you expected Johnson to be a real upgrade at safety. Hill's a good nickel corner. Greedy is a big name, but I haven't really seen, you know, he
good name as well as a big name.
The best thing he's done so far is get away with one of the worst holding things I've ever seen. I think that's where they are right now. And that offense, the difference in one sense is that offensive line, because with the two tackles there, with Treader at center healthy, they are one of the best offensive lines in the league. They can grind the ball out. And then everything Baker does and Stefanski calls looks really good because of that. And it's when Minnesota had their really bad year, was partly because Zimmer lost too many defensive players to be able to make up to, but also because Cook and Madison are able to run the ball, you know, and they can do that.
Was that the Norv year when Norv left midseason?
That was the year before.
The year before,
I think last year it was last year with.
Last year you're talking about. I'm with you. Yeah.
Yeah. He let so many defensive players go for cap reasons. He's brought back a couple this year.
Yes.
When they could get him more cheaply.
About the Cards, Mike? Because
That was a great win for the Cards.
Yeah, I mean, they were rolling this time last year, right? I know Kyler got banged up, so that's obviously instrumental. But do you see? Remove that from the equation. And I know it's a significant part of the equation.
That's a big part. Yeah.
Do you see outside of Kyler a significant, or at least a tangible improvement year on year elsewhere in the team?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this year the defense is, I'm not the only person to notice this, but the defense has really won games for them.
Yeah.
And it's a really good defense. Vance Joseph has done a good job, you know, which is what he's done as coordinator most of the places that he's been. I liked OC giving Chandler Jones. I'm not sure he's the most underrated player because lots of people have noticed how good he is, but that's certainly the OC and I always tend to agree. I remember when we had that thing and he was like, he was giving me a 101 test, you know, and who's the most underrated player in the league? I said, Jarrell Casey.
Yeah,
you're right. And it's like, yeah. It was like, jaws dropped in the room. But yeah, but Chandler Jones is a great football player, you know, and has been for a number of years. And they've got a defense that is both tough up front, but it's also multiple. So Vance Joseph can do lots of different things with it. I picked the Browns to win that game. Before the, you know, if I had known both tackles
went well, Mike,
were declared out, and Chubb was out, I probably wouldn't have. But you know, going into that, I thought, you know, the Browns, and I think either Jason or OC said it yesterday as well about the Browns. You were saying, who do you really like? And said one of them said the Browns.
Because
you look at the Browns, and that was a New York Giants kind of team. You know, they can control the ball on the ground. They can hit the occasional big play, and the defense comes at you with pass rush and frustrates you. They can't do that now. You know?
They can't do it. And Eli's got more to him than Baker, but we'll save that for another.
That's true too. No, that's a very good point. That's one, you know, that's one to discuss at some point, because Eli's got that deep, you know, that kind of deep, I don't care if I throw five interceptions.
Yes.
I'm going to still take that deep shot. And that's what they need.
Unfazable. Right. I wanted to skate on because there are a couple of other big games I want to talk about, big narratives anyway. How did the Ravens put the brakes on this Chargers offense? Why were they so effective?
Wow. Wink is so good. if Wink doesn't get some head coaching interviews, I don't know. You know, Joe Cullen's a coordinator that people are taking his assistants. Cully's a head coach in Houston. Right. Cullen's the defensive coordinator in Jacksonville, and Wink's still doing the same thing with the Ravens. And how did they do it? I think people, even though it's big name secondary, they tended to undervalue the strength of that secondary. First off, they got a couple of big plays, and Herbert made a cut. Well, actually, Mike Williams missed a pass, you know, down the 1 yard line, and where he really should have had the catch. It was a catchable ball, and it just didn't work. But when you watch the Ravens in that game, they were doing an awful lot of what's becoming very fashionable, but they've been doing it for a while. You know, the stand-up eight-man front, you know, whatever you want to call it. You know, some call it 605, or, you know, but it's really more like an 8-3 kind of from formation, where you don't know who's coming and who's not. And the Ravens are traditionally, apart from the big beefs they've had back in the day, and actually not that long ago, because they had Michael Pierce and nose tackle and stuff, but otherwise they like to have these flexible kind of defensive end outside hybrid types, quick inside linebackers. I wonder, Patrick Queen, I think, has been a disappointment for them, but I wonder if they should just switch his and Harrison's roles around, and then they might be happier with both. But they were doing a great job of messing up Justin Herbert in terms of what they were doing and the offensive line. And I think for all of the, they basically shut Austin Eckler out of making big plays as well. And that they dominated up front. And I don't know if the Chargers offensive line is actually as strong as it's looked, because I think Herbert has made it look a bit better in some ways. So yeah, I mean, I picked the Bills. I picked them to cover, although the spread wasn't that great. And I just thought, you know,
The Ravens.
I mean, yeah.
You picked the Bills as well tonight. I picked the Bills tonight,
obviously.
To cover.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, I still put a lot of factor into the that's a Mike Lombardi kind of thing. I put a lot of factor. I put a lot of factor into the West Coast, East Coast biorhythm kind of thing.
Yeah, the travel
for games like that, and I think that probably may have helped the Ravens as well too. But it was a comprehensive game. When you watch the Ravens offense, it's like their running backs are like your fantasy team in 2018. Devontae Freeman, Latavius Murray. I got them.
Still rolling. Lamar's now 35-8 as a starter, which is, I'm reliably informed by producer Ol, the most wins by a quarterback before turning 25 in NFL history, modern era history. You know, a few weeks back, Mark, you had that list of quarterbacks and you said, Jackson, you're not sure if he's on it yet, because I think of reservations about whether he has the same level in terms of what he's seeing and his passing ability. And I know I'm not being challenged to say, well, a couple of weeks, has that completely revised your opinion? But has he taken a few steps further forward to getting on that Carlson list?
Basically? To be honest, I did last week and I thought it was kind of a step back this week. Mm. Not that he played badly or anything, but they went back to the run. They weren't going to throw the ball 40 times like they did last week.
Yeah.
But watching the passes, I'm still not convinced about that, the consistency. He and Mark Andrews have this great connection. They had Andrews quite a bit. Hollywood Brown couldn't quite make a catch. That's still going to be a bit of a worry. And they got Bateman back.
Yes.
He wasn't a huge factor, but that presence, he can do what he's supposed to do, you know, which is be X receiver, draw attention, run slants and stuff like that. So, I get the feeling by the end of the year that Jackson's going to be ripping teams apart, passing, but I'm still waiting to see it actually happen.
Okay. We'll watch that space. A couple more for you, Mike, before we get out of Dodge. Dan Campbell, after the Lions' latest defeat, laying into Jared Goff. And Campbell has set out his stall from press conference one, right? In terms of, we know what we're going to get from him as a head coach, but he didn't pull any punches. He needs to step up and make some throws. So if we're bringing that back to the discussion about old school coaching and the Coughlin carry the ball around the facility all day if you fumble. And does this style of coaching work anymore? It's drill sergeant.
Not really. I think you need to have a certain degree of reality about it. I mean, most of what he's predicted has come true. They've been knocked down on their knees and they keep fighting, but they can't get up off their knees.
Right.
And I said with you, back in the summer sometime, the merger of Dan Campbell with Jared Goff made no sense at all. This is not the kind of quarterback. If Dan Campbell wants to run that kind of team, Jared Goff's not the kind of quarterback to run it. You know, this is not. Now, they can run the ball. Once they fall behind, they can't bother to run the ball, but they couldn't run it at the beginning. So if you're going to build a run first team, you got to be able to run the ball. Goff's not a pocket passer. We know that. He's not going to sit. You have to run play action. You have to move him around. That's what frustrated Sean McVay so much, which is why he was willing, to make that trade, or wanted to make that trade. I think Dan Campbell would be happier with Fitz at quarterback. To be honest. And maybe they ought to be looking at something like that. But to kind of throw Jared Goff under the bus for being Jared Goff seems to me kind of unfair. Mm. We know what he can do well. He's got a nice arm. He can make throws. It's up to your it's not necessarily Dan Campbell, but it's up to him and his offensive coordinator to create an offense that can make Goff more effective.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more.
And if you misread a guy coming out of college, fair play. You've misread him. You thought you could coach him up. If you misread a guy after you've got 3 years of NFL film to watch, then it's your fault, not his. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great point. And you, in the same way that a coordinator will get thrown under the bus to keep the head coach rolling a little bit longer, it's a shade of that at the moment that Campbell
and
the quarterback. He should be doing more.
You know, okay, he's throwing the gauntlet down to Jared Goff to step up. But what does this say to your teammates? You know, your quarterback's got to be in a leadership position. And so you know, if the coach is saying quarterback's not making plays, that's why we're losing. That's not why the Lions are losing.
Thanks, boss. The what's Michael Brock is saying about the situation? That's what I want to.
Oh man, bring me back to St. Louis. Man.
One more on Sunday Night Football, and Geno almost getting it done for Seattle. Do you think that he can keep them in contention?
Yeah, that was the game. I wish I didn't bet it. I wish I'd picked Seattle plus the points. I didn't have enough faith in Geno. And you know, I could see it being a close game, but I just kind of thought there's that smell of the Jets about Geno, which is unfair. I take it back. It was unfair. I was exaggerating for effect. And,
even Rufus didn't bark at that one. That's how.
No, he, and I thought, you know, they kept it close. They could have won. Tomlin was complaining about that. The tying field goal. But realistically, his complaint, you know, and I agree with him. I hate it when they review a play that doesn't need reviewing, and it creates a timeout for the team that doesn't have a timeout. You know, the play didn't need reviewing. The effect was the same, whether the pass was complete or incomplete. They got an extra second out of it or something like that, but that didn't affect the result of the game. So, so the complaint really wasn't that, that strong. And Pittsburgh is such a limited team.
Right.
That's why I should have given Seattle more credit.
Should have given them more credit. So based on what you've seen, can he keep them in the playoff hunt? At least a light touch chance.
Yeah, that's going to be a harder thing, because the frustrating thing about Seattle is that no matter what they do, no matter which offensive coaches they bring in, no matter which line coaches they bring in, they still wind up being the same offense, which depends in the end on Russell Wilson making plays on third and long, and in the fourth quarter. And you know, putting the best spin on Geno, he's not that guy.
Right.
And, you know, if you were asking him to run a pretty steady four quarter kind of offense that didn't require Russell Wilson type chunk plays, then fair enough. But, I think he's going to be left in the lurch by the Seahawks. And in that division, that could be the kiss of death. Now, the D.
Put him in Cleveland and he'd be fine, is what you're saying.
That's an interesting point. That would be a very interesting experiment. I love those switch the quarterbacks. You know, the classic one was Brady and Manning
right.
Back in the Patriots Colts days. You know, if you move them to the other teams, would they be as effective? You know, and
where do you land on that?
In that one, I always said that Manning. It would depend because Brady had already shown himself to be adaptable.
Yes.
He could play in any sort of a system because Belichick required him to play in multiple offensive systems.
This is the key, right? He's just a system quarterback. Well, yeah.
And Peyton, Peyton played his whole career in a Peyton offense.
Yes.
You know, that was designed for him, if not by him.
By him.
and always the same central, kind of thing. And they just executed it so well that no one could stop them. So would Peyton be willing to adjust, or would Bill be willing to adjust, saying, well, we've got Peyton, we don't need to adjust. And I think the difference was when they got into the playoffs, people always said, oh, Peyton's defense let him down, you know. But when you looked at it in reality, their defense was designed to allow 21 points and Peyton would get 28 or more and they would win games. What happened in the playoffs was they allowed 21 points, but other teams' defense would keep would keep Peyton Mitchell down around 21 points as well. And the games would turn into tight games, and they lost, you know, they lost as many of them as they won. And that's one of the anomalies of the NFL is, you know, when, and we tend, especially early in the season, to overvalue teams' wins against teams that turn out to be not so good.
Right.
In the end, now, you know, part of that is self-fulfilling prophecy. But, you know, look at the Patriots. See, you are what Bill Parcells' most famous quote, maybe, you are what your record says you are. Mm-hmm. And you can say, well, God, they were close. They could have had a win here. You know, they should have beaten the Jets. They had the Jets beaten. And then Harris fumbled. You know, they could, you know, they could be, what, 3-3 instead of 2-4, you know, 3-4-2 instead of 2-4, but they're 2-4. And that's probably what kind of a team they are. Jags and Miami are both 1-5 teams. That's probably the kind of teams that they are.
Yeah. It's a great point and a fine point to end on. I'm Mike. You mentioned your Patreon column. Let's send our listeners to check that out. So it's patreon.com/, don't forget the forward
Mike
slash.
Carlson, FMTE, Friday morning tight end, but it never drops on Friday morning. It's always Friday afternoon because there's a lot of writing in there. If I do say so myself, I recommend it, you know, because last week was a long take on John Gruden. One on the week before was one on penalties, you know, so I do tend to kind of do the essay thing rather than pick all the games like I used to do. And I find it much more rewarding, if not financially.
There's not enough of that at the deep dive long read around. So I recommend you go and check it out and educate yourself just a little bit with Carlson Stylings. Brilliant stuff. You've certainly educated us over the last hour. I'm Mike, as you always do. And you'll be back next week in our regular review spot.
Thank you. Bud. Much appreciated. And yeah, we got to do another football game together.
We do. I know. We got Germany's calling, Mike. Germany next year. We've got to get a road trip for that one. That'll be fun.
Willkommen nach American football. Meet Mike Carlson. Ja.
Didn't used to be on Germany Euro.
I might become the Iron Duke if we could do it in Germany.
Wasn't that the old gag that you were on? I'm on Eurosport, but not in this country. I'm on it. Not be on in this country. How are we going to watch you, Mike? Look after yourself, bud.
Thanks, mate.
Lovely stuff from Iron Mike. This is his spot. Every week, catch Iron Mike on Mondays, looking back at all the weekend's action. If you haven't already, subscribe to us wherever you listen to us, because that way you won't miss a trick, because we've got episodes dropping thick and fast. The College Days franchise, courtesy of our resident college expert, Ben Isaacs. Brilliant stuff already in the can, already in the vault there. Ben looking at all the top prospects in college. So you will be up to speed. You'll be ahead of the curve. You'll be able to drop the pub ammo with your mates about receivers, cornerbacks that they don't know anything about. And you can slide in on the inside rail with the stuff that Ben has given you. Edge rush, me and Propo, the unders king of Plumpton. That is a lot of fun. That drops Fridays, maybe early Saturdays sometimes, getting you set for the weekend, all the edge there as well. And I've got to say, gang, we're on fire at the moment. I don't like to be too self-congratulatory, but we are on fire at the moment. We will explain more on this week's episode, but pretty much everything that we called last week came to fruition. Marek Larwood, comedian and Detroit Lions fan, dropping by a bit later on this week. I know he is a fan favorite, so I'm really looking forward to catching up with him. We'll always preview the weekend's action as well as reviewing it with Iron Mike the following Monday. So this is your stop for all the best NFL coverage this season. Great lineup of guests. Stay with us. Subscribe to us at The NC Show on social media. Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Still no TikTok. Or still doesn't watch The Wire. What are you going to do? We'll see you Thursday with Marek. Bye for now.
Sports Social Podcast Network.